Welcome to another episode of Life in Bali. I'm your host, D.C. Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable and able to get out and do whatever you want, while remaining within the confines of the universal precept to do as little harm as possible. The main feature today is a phone chat with Bali Bill, and that will be at 15 minutes and 15 seconds. Yeah, I like this Thursday Life in Bali podcast. I like putting all the non-Zen stuff right here. It's sort of my escape valve. There's more to my life than working on Cuke Archives, although it didn't seem like there's that much more recently. One thing I'm going to do is to throw in a song at the end of the Life in Bali podcast. Today I'm going to put in one called OK Boomerang, and I'll tell you a little bit about it before it plays. The virus report, let's see what's happening with that. Well, the number of positive cases is growing faster now. Now they have reported 760 with 6 deaths. Still, nobody I know or anybody I know knows that I've heard of. But I had lunch yesterday. That's the first time in a couple of months I've done something like that. Soul on the Beach by Pantai Sindhu at Sindhu Beach, which is closed. But it's right near this street. There's a street that runs right down to the beach, and it's got a barricade. Sarah went through that when they said, oh, the beach is closed, you can't come in. She said, well, I'm going to lunch over here, and it's open. So they let her in. And I just went through a hotel grounds that were next to it. And there was nobody there. Anyway, Alice from the Lighthouse Drug Alcohol Treatment Center, and Danu, her husband, and Sarah, and a gentleman named Hatsi I had never met before, and I had lunch. Very nice place. I had the Mediterranean dish with falafel. Ooh, so good. Anyway, I asked, what's happening in Bali with it? What do they know? And they said it's getting worse, and people have been getting it from the night markets. Well, that's one thing they didn't close, because a lot of people go eat at the night markets. And I said, well, I'm thinking of going to the morning market in Sindhu Morning Market just to get some spices that I can't get anywhere else like that. And they said, oh, maybe you shouldn't do that. Well, no, you don't get close to, you don't have to get close to anybody there. And I know just where to go, and I don't know, it seems all right to me. When they closed the beach a month ago, they said they'd open it up now, but they haven't. And I agree with Bill Maher. I've watched some of what he has to say about this. And it's not good to stay indoors. Well, I don't anyway. I go out and get sun. You want to get sun. You want to get vitamin D. You want to get exercise. Just, I think people should be able to get out. They just shouldn't, be right next to each other, to people you don't know, or people you're not living with or whatever. you know, this sort of thing might not go away. And anyway, I've said what I have to say about that. I generally I like to avoid any political statement. Generally, no, I almost always avoid making any political statement. And also avoid giving advice about the virus, but I just did. I mean, I gave my opinion anyway. Mainly, I feel there's no need for me to say what I'm thinking because it all seems so obvious to me. I mean, it's just glaringly obvious. So I think my opinion is expressed without saying anything. But I do have an opinion on something that happened in the political realm recently that I thought I would share. And that is when the President of the United States was at the Naval Academy to give a commencement speech, which was criticized for him getting a bunch of people together. But I don't know, they did it very carefully. Anyway, he was ridiculed and there was all sorts of reporting about how he walked down this ramp afterwards. They say, oh, is he sick? Look, you know. Hey, good Lord, the guy's 74 years old. They should have had a handrail there. That's wrong. He's the president. My God, they should have a handrail for him. They should have a handrail for me. I want handrails. And I play tennis and swim and walk a lot. But when you get older, like I'm 75, he's 74. When you get older like this, you have more of a tendency to fall down, as I have reported. I haven't even reported all of it. You don't want to fall down. I mean, my former father-in-law was in very good shape. And, you know, he would go riding bicycles with a group of guys. And he was somewhere around my age, I think younger. I think he might have been 70. And he was sitting on his bike. And, you know, he lost his balance and fell over and broke his hip. So of all the things to pick at the president about, I would not criticize him for being careful when he walked or discourage him or other people for doing that. That's bad. And then that same day, they're criticizing him for using a second hand when he drinks a glass. That's good form. It's much better to use two hands when you're drinking. Now, in Asia, that's the norm. Well, I don't know about everywhere in Asia. With my Japanese teachers and in Japanese culture, using two hands with a drink is considered good form. I consider it good form here, too. It's sort of off balance and careless just to use one hand. So, yeah, look. So I say to those who nitpicked at the president and ridiculed him for this, maybe you can find something else to criticize the president for other than drinking with one hand and walking carefully down a ramp. All right, enough of that. That's my outraged political commentary for the day. So I might as well go into an accident report there. I said I have fallen down more times than I've reported. When my friend Gregory came to visit last fall. Oh, God, I don't know what happened. I fell down five times in front of him in the first week he was here. And you know, Gregory's a body worker and always thinking of the body and taking care of yourself and this and that. I don't know, we'd be walking along and I'd hit something on the sidewalk, bang, and I'd be down. We were looking at some new tile work in a very far out sort of, very far out bathroom. I've mentioned Tanya's place, Lumbung Damu, down near Chandidasa. It's really far out. And they have this bathroom with new tile work on it and stuff, you know, and it's like half outside. And I walked in, you know, I didn't have any, you know, I'd taken my sandals off and I walked in and I put one foot on the tile, bang, just slippery, you know, it was wet and just went out from under me. Then we were at a temple. We were at that wonderful temple in Uluwatu that has the monkeys and lots of tourists where they have the kachak ceremony. Wouldn't call it a dance. The kachak, where all the guys, it's one of the greatest things here. It's all male, a cappella, chanting the monkey chant, and then they have a fire ceremony. So before you do that, right there, and that's at the very southern tip of Bali on a cliff, as the sun goes down and they come out and do that. That is great. That was great. I really turned on to it in 92 when I was here. And I first heard the kachak when Andy Weil played it on a tape in about 1978 in Tucson. He'd been to Bali and he played it and it was so compelling. I just went, wow, that is so great. I want to hear that. And then 78, 88, so 14 years later, I was in Bali for 2 months and I heard the kachak 3 times, but it was like at night outside, like with 100 guys, you know, with like 30 tourists. It's not like that now. They have them all over with fewer guys, but it's still cool. So anyway, we were at that temple. I forget what it's called. It's on YouTube because the monkeys there will steal things from you, as monkeys will do just about anywhere you go where there's a lot of monkeys near people. They'll take things from you, glasses, pens out of your shirt. Really be careful and don't carry any food. they were on YouTube because they were getting into returning it for money. Very interesting. And, you know, I saw monkeys take things from people when we were there, and it was fairly crowded. Anyway, we're going up some very steep steps. Bang! I slipped and fell right down on the steps. And Gregory's going, David, you got to watch out. That's the fourth time, or maybe it was the fifth time. I just kept falling down. But that spurt ended. I've hardly fallen down at, well, just the times I've reported. I can think of one other. I'm really careful not to. That's why I really didn't like that thing about criticizing Trump for walking carefully down a ramp. Good Lord. Okay, end of accident report. I think we could just go straight into hearing a phone chat now with Anthony Bali Bill Pierce, a really great friend and character here, who's been here a long time. You're just about to hear about it. And he's a pretty interesting guy. So here we go with Bali Bill. Hey, well, I'm going to say one thing. I met him through tennis. Played tennis together a lot. I'm not playing right now because the doctor didn't want me to because of a hernia I have. He said he's worried it's going to make it worse. And he's not playing tennis now either because of a tennis elbow. But he's pretty active. I see him around even now. You know, he gets around. And he's like my age. I don't know exactly how old he is. Maybe it says in his phone chat. So here we go with Bali Bill. I would like to record our conversation and just throw a little in on my Life in Bali podcast that I put up on Thursdays. Is that all right with you?
Well, yeah, I would prefer if I could have known the question beforehand or what you want me
to talk about. No, it doesn't matter.
No?
Okay. Because I can come back to you. You're a person we could come back to.
Right.
So, better off the top of your head. You're very natural.
Okay. My
God, you don't have any trouble talking. let me ask you first, because I'm interested in all this, and I've heard some of it, but of course, you know, at my age, it all just falls down on the floor. When did you first come to Bali? What year?
1971.
Wow. And how old were you?
I was, I'd have been 25.
No kidding.
25 years old, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it really, Bali actually hit me for six. I just totally fell in love with everything about it. Kuta, the streets were earth. There was no electricity. Most of the villages that you went to, there was no electricity. There were just ordinary small oil lamps with the mantle. Mm. The very small, like a little glass base and the mantle on top. Mm-hmm. And so the effect of that and the effect of dramas and ceremonies, which were torchlit then because there was no electricity, it was just magical, absolutely magical. You know what it's like if you have a performance where the performance itself is lit by torches, so you've got the flickering shadows and the flickering lights, and it's all very soft and it's just very, very magical.
Mm.
And it was just so easy to meet Balinese and the way that they smiled. I mean, personally, I was always from very early age one to sort of feel happy and smile. I did a lot of smiling in my life. Most of the time, like 99% of the time, I've felt a happy sort of demeanor.
Hmm.
And I've studied yoga for many years, and probably that might, although I was initially a happy child. And to meet people, like if you compared people that I would meet in England. I worked around farms after doing an engineering apprenticeship. And people in the middle of the black country could be quite, they had a good sense of humor, but they could be quite serious too, as could people in London. And everywhere you went in Bali, there were no mirrors. There was only really one or two basic hairstyles for females. And so with the hair pulled back off the face and the hair being done by their sisters, there was no ego, if you see what I mean. Which was also very, it was the first time I'd lived anywhere where there were no mirrors. And that was very interesting. I found that extremely interesting. And it just knocked me for six, and I wanted to, you know, I felt like I wanted to live here.
Mm. And you just arrived as a tourist, right?
I was basically, I'd worked in, I'd left England when I was about 23 or 4, gone to Australia, and I'd worked in Sydney for nearly a year, and decided to come to Bali on a holiday on the way back to England. So the first time was only 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I got back to England and sold off stuff that I had to be able to come back out. And then arriving back about 2 months later, after that first trip of 3 weeks, I then got into this sort of period of going to Australia to get money and then coming back and living in Bali. And, you know, it was to and fro-ing for quite a while.
And the money would...
And in that period of to-ing and fro-ing, I was in Bali. I was studying painting. I was studying silverwork, language, everything about... Or I tried to study most of the facets of Balinese life. I felt that I wanted to get married here, so I felt that I ought to to know something about it. So I had a teacher who was a shaman, Katut Lea, and I had Deva Batran, who was an artist, and I lived in one of Deva Batran's pondoks in Parsecon, where Lawrence and Lorne Blair actually had a house.
He lived in a pondok, which is like a hut, a cottage. And he lived next to Lawrence and Lorne Blair, very famous anthropologists, ethnologists who studied Indonesia for decades and made the very famous 1988 documentary, five-part documentary for BBC, Ring of Fire, an Indonesian Odyssey. Emmy Award winning.
And, yeah, it was sort of like, a life of exploring, walking the rice paddies, eating the local food, studying half the day with the shaman and then sort of painting a bit or learning to draw and paint. It was, it was a very interesting period. Well, it's been an ongoing interesting period, actually.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't stop there.
Uh-huh.
Because I got married, I eloped, and so I couldn't go back to Pongasekon to stay because the Dewa who I was living in the pondok of was distantly related to my wife's family, and he was worried that the royal family of Ubud and everywhere would come down on him. So initially I said to David, can I bring my wife? And he said, yeah, sure. What's her name? And I said her name, and he said, oh, well, sorry, but you better not.
Yeah, because her name's Chalk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was quite amusing.
So
yeah.
I'd like to go back and have you tell us how you met Chalk and how you came to elope and how you came to the decision to marry her.
Well, I had been doing yoga fairly over many years. And when I got to Bali, I found myself basically in a natural yoga environment. The people were very knowledgeable in stories from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and they had their own also system, if you like, like a philosophy that's called Kakawin. And Kakawin is actually relating to the marriage of your earthly self to your Atma or your overself. In other words, yoking yourself, which I'd already studied in sort of yoga partly. And so this was like another area of study here that at ceremonies where, or in the Wayankuit, the language that's actually used for Kakawin is different to the actually ordinary level of Balinese. It's more bordering, it's closer to Sanskrit. And Sanskrit being, it's a very, how can I say, it's a language of spirituality, really. By sort of speaking in Sanskrit, you basically you can sort of put yourself into a spiritual state. So Kakawin is the Bahasa Kawi or Kawi language, the old Javanese, which comes from a Hindu source, as it were, having a Sanskrit basis. And so there are many, the Ramayana story will actually have a Kakawin language level, which is the more inner meaning of the spiritual meaning of the actual story itself. And basing all the philosophy is based on yoking the earthly soul to the heavenly soul, because the theory is that we come from a heavenly source.
That's interesting you use the word yoking, because that's where the word yoga comes from.
That's the meaning of yoga.
Yeah.
Yoga means yoking. And so I found myself here after returning here, I found myself in this very yogic, if you like, environment. And I, through the different interactions and the different teachings of the shaman himself and other Balinese and artists and sort of people who were, let's say, spiritually, a little bit more spiritually developed, I heard many different, you could say, little stories and bits of knowledge about the actual culture itself. Now, one of those that came up often, when you were sitting around talking to people, you would sometimes, often, you'd hear the chit-chatting. Mm-hmm. So, you know the sound of a chit-chatting? Yeah, you know that?
Yeah, the little
sound?
Lizards, yeah.
Okay. So the folklore about that is that if you hear the chit-chat, if it's singing in the northern hemisphere above you, what you're thinking at that split second is correct. Mm. If it's below you or in the southern hemisphere, you're wrong. It's not correct. I should say correct and not correct rather. So I sort of, through what I was doing yoga, I was meditating quite a lot, and I was doing a lot of exercises in mind exploration. And I would use the chit-chat to correct me or to tell me that I was on the right track or the wrong track. And mm-hmm. and it became a very, how can I say, I was very attentive to, I still am. And it's amazing how you can be sitting with a group of people and you can be making a point, for instance, about something, maybe something philosophical or whatever, and you'll suddenly hear that split second you say something, you'll hear the chit-chat go off. And if you're with Balinese, they sort of nod to each other and say, yes, that's correct, or that's not correct. You know, this sort of knowledge is sort of disappearing. The younger people are not as attentive as that particular, you could say, makeup of people in those days, because they didn't have television, see?
Yeah.
They only had their entertainment was always either Wayne Coolidge or dramas. It was always teaching, Sanskrit teachings about the Mahabharata and the Ramayana.
The first thing he mentioned there was Wayang Kulit. Wayang is a Javanese word meaning shadow. Kulit means skin. And Wayang Kulit is the traditional puppet shadow theater. And the puppets are made out of leather that were cut in silhouettes and held up with long, thin sticks. And they're very delicate and fine-looking, and they're held behind a screen with a light shining on them from the other side. Traditionally, it was like a coconut oil lamp. And so it projects these silhouettes on the screen, and the audience sits there and watches dramas unfolding between good and evil.
Mm-hmm. So they had that intrinsic education of spirituality. Everywhere you went, you could always have a very beautiful conversation in Marans, and people were very very educated in the spiritual. So anyway, one day I was living in Batran, and my neighbour, who was a teacher working in Lombok, came around and said, I'm going tonight to the temple down the road in Megara. There's an Odalan ceremony happening there. And Odalans were always really nice to go to because there was dancing and there was wine coolers and whatever and festivities and sort of like beautiful Balinese girls and beautiful people. So I always used to enjoy that. So I agreed I would go with him that particular evening. And we waltzed off down the road about 7 o'clock, went into the temple, prayed, or Sembayang, which is sort of, okay, the translation, as it were, is to pray, where you take the holy water after holding a flower in your hands 3 times. So then you're blessed with the water. And we came out, and the temple had a bar area, very, very natural, countryside of a bar, nothing like a Western bar, where they sold tea, coffee, and refreshments for the people that would have come to the temple to make their offerings from slightly further away than the local village.
Mm.
And we sat down at a table, and my wife actually was the elder of the girls who were operating the particular bar. And she sat down and said to my friend, where's your friend from? And I replied, and she was a bit surprised that I could speak to Holland. Anyway, we chatted for about an hour, and then we left. And on the way back, my neighbor, who he was a Brahmana, I lived in a Griha, which is the house of a Brahmana family. And on the way back, he said, you know, that lady she's not married. You ought, maybe if you're looking for a wife, she'd make a good wife. So what happened then was that I actually, with the help of the Brahmana guy that I was living with at the time, or staying in his house, we made a letter, and my wife would come to the end of the road near where I was staying to go back to her office in Klungkung, and I managed to get this letter to her because I felt that I'd been led by my over-self, or my Atma. I was looking for a wife, and I didn't want to, as it were, choose myself. So I had in my meditations been asking for an indication of who would be the right lady to actually get married to. And I felt that this lady was the one. So we arranged, or I met her about a week later in her office. And then another week later in Denpasar, and we went and sat on the cliff at Tanalot, and it was there that I put the suggestion to her. Unfortunately, the best day to get married for the next 25 years was the 23rd of May, and this was only about a couple of weeks before that. So she actually said, can I think about it? Yeah, would you give me time to think about it? Can't you wait and you know, do it in a few months or whatever, get to know each other? I said, no, it has to be that date. Because I'd been studying with the shaman and knew how to read the Balinese calendar, which you have indications of every day has a certain characteristic and a certain day, or every day is good or bad for some sort of activity. So you can block there to find out. I then went to, through the family that I was living with, who were Brahmana, they had a relative in Subangadei who was a priest, a high priest, and I went to him and arranged for the marriage offering to be made by him. And then on the 23rd, I went to Klungkung and basically kidnapped my wife and then took her to a safe house. And then from the safe house in the evening, we then went to the Gria, where we had the ceremony. And from there, back to Denpasar, to the house that I rented. So, yes, it was, it was a little bit unusual, but, well, we're still married. 45 years, we've just had our, our wedding anniversary.
Why don't you explain why you two had to elope?
Why I had to what?
Elope.
Oh, okay. Well, my wife being a Chakorda, traditionally the royal families of Bali, or that particular royal family, it was not acceptable for a Chakorda to get married to anyone other than a Chakorda. That was the sort of rule of the family. And in fact, I think before me, it's a local guy, a local, let's say, of lower caste, had tried to disappear or elope, they would have been prevented from it. So it had to be totally secret. In fact, my mother-in-law ran away with a Brahmana. And in theory, let's say, if you have a hierarchy in the caste system, which is in a way true, that the higher the caste, yeah. So your royal caste is not the highest caste. The highest caste is the Brahmana caste. And in roughly the 1940s, at some stage, my wife's mother had run off with a Brahmana. And she'd been discovered by her father before they had the ceremony. And she was forcibly taken back to the village and forced to marry my wife's father, who was a Chakorda, to keep the name, as it were, intact. So that's why I had to do it in secret and why I had to elope. And, in fact, nobody could know. I had to get it all done. The ceremony, certainly the ceremony done before anybody found out, because once the ceremony had taken place, then, as it were, our marriage had been ordained by God. Therefore, nobody could then disturb that. That was sort of like it. It was valid. The validation is the ceremony.
And did her family, how did her family respond once they learned? How did they relate to you?
Well,
and how long did that process take?
Oh, okay. Well, I could only visit when it was dark. I couldn't go to the house in the daylight. And basically that lasted until our first son was born. And then it all became totally acceptable. But, I mean, I was sort of accepted as long as I went in under cover of darkness to visit the family house.
And how long after you were married was your son born?
May, March. So, in fact, on our... I'd only had 3 hours with my wife before we married, a total of 3 hours. And all we didn't even hold hands. We didn't even touch each other. We just talked very little. And so then, in fact, we married and we went to the house that I'd rented. And I think it was within that first month. I don't think my wife menstruated. So it happened fairly quickly that she became pregnant. And John was born on the 18th of March the following year.
And what year was that?
1976. I got married on the 23rd. We got married on the 23rd of May. So 23rd makes 5. It was the 5th day in numerical value, the 5th month of 1975. And if you add up those numbers, that comes to 32, comes to 5. So it was definitely a 5-day, which being midway between 0 and 10 for me was like an equality it also balanced. It was a balanced number, as well as being a fortuitous day in the calendar, in the Balinese calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So you and your wife got married in 75?
Yeah. And so, first child came in 76, March.
So were you still going back to Australia at that point for money?
No, I was able to get a sociable dyer. I was actually on a sociable dyer when I married. But then when I went into immigration, somehow they found out. How did they find out I was married? I think I had to tell them that my status had changed from being single. You have to put it on the right. Forms. Now, they then threatened to kick me out. And in fact, one of my wife's cousins helped me to arrange for a chattatanti, in other words, a civil registry marriage. And so on the civil registry marriage, that happened on the 11th of September, 1975. And shortly after that, I was, as it were, expelled from Indonesia and had you to go to Australia.
Did she come with you?
No, I couldn't afford. We had no money, either of us. We both got married on a shoestring. In fact, a very short shoestring at that. And she'd been working in the government office, so they weren't very well paid at that time. Anyway, it was a very rocky road. We had a very rocky road because we were both basically penniless. And I then, obviously, in those days, you still had to have a ticket to go out when you came in. So I did have a ticket back to Australia, but I didn't have a job. So I arrived back in Australia and then had to get work. And it was a rocky start. Very rocky.
Mm-hmm.
But we made it. And, yeah.
How long before you came back in?
I left in the September. I persuaded a friend to lend me some money. And I was back in December to buy some handicrafts, which I then took back to Sydney. So I wasn't long in December. I could only stay about a week or so and visit and, you know, stay with my wife for just a short period of time before going back to try and grab that money to try and sell these carvings in Paddy's Market in Sydney so that I could be back in time for the birth of my son in March. Now, I also got a job with a guy called John Forsyth who had promised that he'd send me back in March before my son was born, and I would be like a manager of one of his sort of he had a voucher system, and he said he needed a manager. So anyway, I helped him for a couple of weeks, and then he reneged on the deal, which made me not able to get over for my son's birth. And it wasn't until about the next September that I was able to get my wife over to Australia.
Oh.
So.
did you get her over there without you coming to Bali?
Yeah. I was able to send her a ticket and get her over
to Australia. Did you just communicate through mail?
No, I would phone her. The cousin that she was staying with actually worked in the tourism office, Kairosata, but he was in charge of education. And so he did actually have a home phone. so we were able to occasionally talk on the phone. And I was able weekly to send money over to her so I could support her from the work I was doing in Australia.
Oh. Oh. So she came to Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. And we stayed there for probably about 8 or 10 months, I think. And then back again to Bali.
Back again, who, her or both of you?
No, both of us. Both of us. With my son. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Good.
And what did you do when you got back in Bali? And where did you live?
I lived in Batran. And I was sort of assisting the family that I knew to try and set up some working pavilions and an exhibition pavilion, and I would actually buy carvings in the market which were unfinished, and then I'd finish them, polish them, finish them, and sell them to foreigners. And we got four pavilions built, and we got the bones of the exhibition pavilion done, and then sadly, the Brahmana friend, was a bit of a compulsive gambler, and he lost the lot on a cockfight, all the cattle. So I realized at that point that I would have to make a break and you know, go and set up my own house, because I couldn't be going on, you know, losing money that was coming in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, odds and ends, this and that, and we survived somehow. And then, in fact, we moved up to Singaraja to start a homestay. Again, that was pretty tough on my wife. She did really well in handling that. Because a place on the beach with no walls at first, it was pioneering, I guess. Not easy. It was a shack that I bought. I bought 600 square meters of land, and that already had an existing shack. And over the next year or two or three, or it was actually 6 years it took me to get 11 rooms that I could rent out, and you know, we started off with four, and then another four, and then a Lumbung price barn.
Yeah, is that the same place you have now?
No. We sold that in 1990, quite a while ago. In fact, at that time we were actually in England. I moved everybody over in 1988, and eventually the place sold in 1990. So,
why did you all go to England?
My mother was 83 in 1988, and she sort of I visited England, and I felt that I could combine sort of being around near to her and helping her in her old age, and at the same time put my kids into an English school. So we moved over there.
And how many kids did you have?
So we had three then. Three boys. 10, 11, and 12 years old.
Oh.
So, we had a... It was interesting because my mother was really happy to have us around, and we were able to live in a house nearby, and it worked out well.
How long were you there?
Until about 98. My mother passed away when she was 93, and we then moved back. Mm-hmm. Moved back here.
What did you do when you were in England?
Well, first of all, I tried to get a job, and the first job I had was as an area manager probation, sort of trainee area manager for Kentucky Fried Chicken. Now, that didn't work out because they promised that after a month's training, I'd get a car and an area. But it turned out to be a bit of a scam. They basically wanted people to work in their KFC outlets, just as, you know, selling chicken. So fortunately, I'd read the small print in the contract, and I could get out if I gave notice within 31 days. And I went to the manager and said, right, when do I get my car? When do I get my area? And he said, oh, you'll have to do some more training before you get that. So I said, oh, well, never mind then. And I'd also, before that, I'd sort of approached a guy who advertised for a salesman. This was a guy who had he had 14 principals that he sold for, and he wanted to split them down and keep seven and give me seven. And so I then sold. It was plastic trunking, heritage brass fittings, burn tube, which is galvanized pipes, and a few other things connected with the electric industry. And I raised his turnover. I doubled his turnover within 8 months. And then because he'd already promised I'd get a new car if I did this, and I'd get a raise, and then he reneged on that. So I left him and started importing slate from Java, because another old friend from way back, needed somebody to help sell his fiberglass roofing system, and also slate. And because I knew Indonesia, we got a container of slate and marble from Indonesia. And then the recession hit, and the first page to go in a recession are the building trades. So I actually then I helped my friend out by resigning from his company, and I went to the employment exchange in England and was offered to sort of do a course in cabinet making and joinery, City and Guilds course. So it turned out to be the last City and Guilds that they ran. I did a 5-year course in 3 years, and I got 5 distinctions out of 6 subjects, and thoroughly enjoyed myself for 3 years doing, you know, what I enjoyed. I'd be working out on site with carpenters, and I'd be making furniture and working in the college, doing, you know, exam pieces and stuff like that. I mean, I'd built already at that stage, I'd built Homestay Agung, and so I knew a little bit about joinery and woodwork, and it was perfect for me to go into that and you know, study something that I love doing. So after that, I then started importing handicrafts from Bali to England. And interestingly for me, if I go back to when I lived in Pangasinan and was studying with a shaman and studying painting, there would be carvers that would come in and they'd ask me what they should be carving or making. And one of the ideas I gave to a couple of carvers one day was to make flowers out of wood and paint them. And so, although that then turned into a very big industry for some people, because there were buyers that were coming through even then in those early days, and they saw somewhere wooden tulips. And I actually never dealt with wooden tulips until 1996 or 95, when I started importing stuff into England. And it was nice because the idea and the two products that I'd created in the 70s, I was able to, you know, take to England and sell. So I was doing furniture from Japara, handicrafts from Bali, and I would do markets, steam rallies. I'd do leisure shows in England, like car sort of, you know, antique car or veteran vintage car meets, markets, or a whole lot of different areas that I would actually go to set up a stall or an exhibition type of partition thing at a trade fair, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did until we moved back. Yeah.
Mm. Now, when you were importing stuff from Bali and from Java, did you have to come to Indonesia to set it up?
Oh, yeah, I had to come here to buy it, yeah. You couldn't necessarily...
Uh-huh.
Well, you'd take a risk if you didn't, I'll put it that way. I mean, my sort of criteria for quality might have been different to a local person's criteria. So it was always...
Yeah, right.
Always come and I'd buy and I'd stuff the container. It would only take me a couple of weeks. And then I'd be back to England and the container would be on the seas. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, what sort of transport did you use when you first came and then, you know, as it progressed through the years?
Well, okay, the first actual bit of transport I used was a Honda 70cc Bebek. In other words, the step-through Honda, or a Suzuki Fat Tire. And I think, if I remember rightly, I think for a step-through Honda, I think it was about 100 rupees a day. Bear in mind that one night in a Lossman was 400 rupiah, and a dollar, an American dollar, was 400 rupiah. So to stay in a Lossman for a night would be a dollar, and if you rented a motorbike, you could, I think it was about a quarter of a dollar.
Yeah.
So motorbikes, you know, step-throughs were the thing, and either that or you know, if I couldn't afford to rent a bike, I'd use BMOs. And in those days, you had a three-wheeler BMO operating. It was a Daihatsu, two-stroke engine, very small.
Mm.
And that went around Denpasar and all the way to Kuta, actually. And the fare mm-hmm. from Denpasar to Kuta was 25 rupiah. And then when I got married, I at first didn't have any transport. I used to use BMOs, and then eventually I was able to buy a motorbike, and that was a Honda GL125. A few years later, it was a Colt minibus, a very battered old thing that a shaman had owned. It was okay. That would boil.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was mainly motorbikes that you got around on. I did anyway.
Yeah, and you had to go around and BMOs a lot of times on dirt roads, right?
Oh yeah. And when we were setting up in Singaraja, well, I would often do that road from, you know, through Badugul down to Denpasar and back again. If I had 10,000 rupees for every time I'd done that trip, I'd be probably a wealthy man.
Wow. And how did you, what sort of transport did you take to get from Australia? So you just, did you fly?
From Australia to Bali, it flew, yeah. In those days, what I did actually in 71, I actually drove up from Sydney to Darwin in a Volkswagen, which was then sold in Darwin. And in those days, there was a plane that went from Darwin to Dili in Timor.
Yeah.
East yeah. Timor it was then, and from Dili to across to Bali. So that first time I flew in, I can't remember what sort of aircraft it was, but it was only a twin-engine thing with about 50 or 80 people. And then from there, I think I flew out from Jakarta to England. So that would have obviously been a trip on a BMO to Gilimanuk and then across to Ketapang on the ferry and then across the across Java to Jakarta and then take an aircraft out of Jakarta. And then coming back the same from London to Jakarta and then train across Java back into Bali.
So when you came back to Bali in 98, what happened then?
Okay, well, I'd sold the business in England and cashed up. And what I then did, just before moving back here, I'd been making maneuvers to get back. And Suharto was nearly toppled. He was toppled from power. And the rupiah went through the floor. And for me, fortunately, I was going past the money change one day and noticed that the pound was five times higher than it normally was. So I was able to rent premises in Ubud to set up a furniture showroom. And I put furniture from Japara, Java in the showroom. And I was, as it were, helping people who were exporting containers, helping them to buy and to coordinate, as well as having the show there.
Where did the containers go out from?
They went out from Houston, Surabaya. Benoa was... Uh-huh. It was open, but it was actually worked out more expensive to send from Benoa because the ship going from Surabaya was much more frequent, the service. And Bali was sort of out on limb, as it were. So it was, you paid a trekking fee, they called it, but it was still cheaper to send and ship from Surabaya than it was from Benoa. Might have changed now. It might be the same or it might be cheaper. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you all lived in Ubud then?
Yeah. Yeah, we lived up there.
And how long did that continue?
I had the premises up there for about 7 years. In fact, when I immediately moved back, I didn't immediately live in Ubud. I lived in this housing estate where I am here. But then moved to, in fact, we didn't get that until slightly a bit later. So I initially moved back and lived in around Sanur in this housing estate and rented for about a year and then moved to Ubud. And
what was Sanur like then?
Quiet. Just very quiet. I mean, you're talking about...
That was about 99.
The actual fun park was Taman Festival was in operation. That was actually working. So they had a magic mountain thing on a Saturday night and they had laser lights going into the sky. But the rest of Sanur was very quiet. Not much going on at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that place, I've been through that. That's a ruin.
It's derelict now.
All overgrown.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is fantastic. It's like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, it used to be. I mean, there was a crocodile pen that had quite a lot of crocodiles in it.
What happened to them?
They, about 2 or 3 years ago, finally, they were billeted out to zoos around Indonesia and I think the Bali Safari Zoo and different places in Indonesia after a lot of strife.
2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah, only about 2 or 3 years ago. They were moved.
I was walking around in there 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You mean there were crocodiles in there?
Yeah, well, there was a pen.
Could they get out?
No, they couldn't get out of the pen. It was like a depression in the ground, and there was a wooden bridge that you could go up onto, but it didn't. I think it went over the pen, the wooden bridge. But you wouldn't want to go without a guide, and you want to be really careful because, you know, some of the floorboards on the bridge had rotted out. And I'm talking about three-meter crocs, some of them. But it was an issue with the WWF because, in fact, I had a friend who I took there, and he tried to raise the issue with WWF because the crocs were actually eating each other. You know, they weren't being fed, so it wasn't a very good condition that they were in.
Hmm. What happened to them? Where'd they go?
Well, some went to Surabaya Zoo, some Jakarta Zoo. They were just, you know, farmed out to various places and the safari park here in Bali. I think they were...
Yeah.
Yeah, they were got rid of, thankfully. I mean, there was one time about 20 years ago when one of them or one or two of them got out, and fortunately they found, the locals found them and put them back in. But you know, I've walked that beach, and for many times walking, I'd be looking behind me and to make sure I wasn't being followed by a croc.
Right. Well, I think there's crocodiles. I went to the reptile garden, you know, the reptile bird. I went there once. Oh, that was about 5 years ago with my sister.
Mm-hmm.
$26 each to get in.
Yeah.
Dollars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we paid in rupiah, but good Lord. One time was enough. And it was neat. They didn't have a Komodo dragon.
Right.
No, they had a Komodo dragon. They didn't have a monitor lizard.
Right.
Of all things, they're all over, and they didn't have one. I wanted to show them one. But they had crocodiles. They were the biggest things I ever saw in my life.
Right.
My God, they were big.
Yeah.
And that's where they came from, I guess.
Just as an aside, you know, I was going up Jalan Kasari the other day, and there was a monitor lizard in the road. It had obviously gone for a visit out of the, you know, the area. If you turn into Kasari, you know Kasari? Before you get to the Hyatt.
Yeah.
You know, after the Maya Hotel, you turn right.
Oh, my
right.
God, there was one on Kasari? Oh, how neat.
Yeah. And it was quite, at least a meter long and quite fat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see. But that's, of course, the area where a few years ago, not so long ago, there was a security of the Hyatt that was actually strangled by a python. That, you know, in
that's
those,
the year we... That's,
that, yeah.
That's when we moved here. That happened shortly after we moved here. We moved here in 2013 in December.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And, right, it made international news.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those two areas, there were two areas. The one has disappeared now. The beach side has been developed. But that was a big area of, like, virgin, jungle, actually, leading up to the Hyatt, on the same side as the Hyatt. But the other side used to have a Chinese restaurant that was owned by the Hyatt. But a lot of trees and quite an area that things like pythons and you know, monitor lizards could actually live quite easily in. So, David,
wow.
I'm being summoned by my wife, and she wants to eat.
Well, that's very good. That can be part one.
What's this for? It's for a podcast for what?
I put up a podcast 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Tuesday, I read Crooked Cucumber and comment on it.
Oh, yeah.
And tomorrow, I will put up Chapter 8 of Crooked Cucumber. With comments, and that'll be 2.5 hours.
Right.
Because the comments are really long.
Uh-huh.
And then on Thursday, I have Life in Bali, and that's just anything I want.
Okay.
You know? Let me get away from the Zen thing a little. And then, although I had my friend Monet, who's, you know, the Theravadan monk you see walking around with the orange robes around here. He's tall. You might have even met him.
Oh, yeah.
And that was interesting. And then on Saturday, I put up a phone chat with somebody having to do with Zen and Suzuki and all that. And I'll have Buddhist scholars or students or teachers or whatever.
Great.
And then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I put up what I call mini podcasts.
Yeah.
And actually, before I called you, I got one up.
Nice.
Today, and it just took me 15 minutes to make it.
Okay.
And I just read a vignette from a little book of vignettes about my teacher that I made called Zen is Right Here, and I make a little comment on it.
Right.
So that's 6 days a week.
Huh.
And
busy lad. You're a busy lad.
Oh, yeah, very busy.
Yeah.
I'm very busy now.
All right.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get as much done as possible because Katrinka is stuck.
Oh,
in America and can't
still.
Get back.
Right.
She's been gone 3 months now, yeah.
Wow.
So I'll get back in touch with you in a couple of weeks.
Okay. All righty.
That was great. Excellent.
Okay. No problem.
And give my love to Chalk.
Will do.
All right?
Will do. Okay. And if we don't see you, we'll see you, hear from you in a week or two. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
very good.
David.
Very
all
good.
Right.
All right,
hey,
take care. Thanks.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Now I'm going to play a song called OK Boomerang. You remember, like, just 2019, wasn't it? OK Boomer was a big deal, right? You screwed up the world, heck with you, we don't need to listen to you, you've caused all the problems, that sort of thing. It was a thing. I mean, it was like the Washington Post or somebody called it the year of OK Boomer. And I thought about it, and it reminded me of certain things. And so I did a little song called OK Boomerang. Back in Berkeley when I was in my prime, east to west a man were running crime. A lot of young uns stood up against the dirty, saying, don't trust anyone over 30. They snubbed them out with a big fat brush. Now here we go again. Some things ain't changed that much. She said, okay, Boomer. I said, I came sooner. From the prior rotation, I'm the silent generation. Lordy, that's a riot. No one ever called me quiet. But the silence failed you too, left an awful mess for you. May you have succeeded. Well, we were stampeded. And not find out like we did. You're outnumbered and outbleated. So, bang your clangor and bless your anger and put us all to shame. But watch out, M, and watch out, Z, for the OK Boomerang. She said, OK, Boomer, continuing presumer. Anyway, that's the rumor. Still, it haunts us like a tumor. There's a pile of woe upon us, and I fear we all are goners. For so many were beguiled from the days when they were child. But you don't owe us a friggin' thing.
for being duped in that Ponzi scheme. Hell, you deserve a new solar system, but the spoils were spent on a glitter and jism. So bang your clanger and bless your anger and put us all to shame. But watch out, M, and watch out, Z, for the okay boomerang. She said, okay, Boomer, which I received in all good humor. And of course, I gladly step aside, but there's nowhere left to hide in any way. And yet, you're gonna need all the allies you can get. But even if all of them do their best, how the heck gonna pass that test? But I've seen games where I'd given up, and then my team come back and whoop their butts. So on land and sea and sky, let's give it that a good old a drop-out try. And bang your clanger and bless your anger and put us all to shame. But watch out, M, and watch out, Z, for the okay boomerang. So bang your clanger and bless your anger and put us all to shame. But watch out, M, and watch out, Z, for the okay boomerang. Okay.
So this has been another episode of Life in Bali. Thanks, Bali Bill. That was great. We'll have Bali Bill back. He's got more to tell us. You're of such a mind, would appreciate it if you go to the homepage of CUKE.com, CUKE.com, and on the near the top of the page and near the bottom are these donate links. And if you click on that, you go to the donate page, and you can either send a check or you can contribute through PayPal or become a PayPal subscriber for as little as $1 a month. It's easy to do and lots of fun. Oh, hey, there's a donate button on CUKE Audio Podbean page 2. So, until next time, this is DC Poobah of CUKE Audio and CUKE Archives with Bondette with Doggett Bandita and Feline Cuchita. But without dearest, lovely Katrinka, tucked away here in Sleepy Sanur, wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.